This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome back to The Bookshelf, where you get to hear about new fiction worth knowing about. I'm Cassie McCullough, and with me today, a bloke who's definitely worth knowing about. I like to think of him as a reader's reader. But he's also a playwright and artistic associate at Belvoir Theatre. Tom Wright, hello.
Hello, Cassie McCullough. Good to be on the shelf again.
Nice to have you. And my goodness, we have certainly given you quite a reading load this time.
This time, Caledonian Road by Andrew O'Hagan. Remember that title because you're going to be hearing about it a lot if you're an assiduous reader. 641 pages. Biting portrait of contemporary British class, politics, money, art, and following five families in the form of it's a modern day Middlemarch, it's a modern day Vanity Fair.
Yeah, it's enormous, and we're about to talk about that. And we'll also talk about the 403-page high concept murder mystery by Stuart Turton.
Called The Last Murder at the End of the World. 122 villagers on an isolated island somewhere in the ocean, three scientists, it's post-apocalyptic, the world might be coming to an end, the species might be over, and there's a deadly fog on the march.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Also, Halfway House by Australia's Helen Fitzgerald. It's set in a Gothic terrace in Edinburgh where an Australian expat called Lou is in charge of a household of violent offenders who have done their sentence but aren't quite ready to be released into the community. And she is the night manager. What could possibly go wrong? But Tom, let's kick off on the streets of a London that is both fabulous and falling apart. So, Tom, Andrew O'Hagan, I think, is something of a British literary star. I mean, for starters, he's an editor-at-large at the London Review of Books. That's a pretty cool gig. He has written a number of novels. His most recent one was Mayflies, which was much loved. And three of his other novels have been nominated for the Booker Prize, including his debut.
He's also the author of several non-fiction books. He's written about rather fraught experience, shall we say, as a ghostwriter for Australia's own Julian Assange. There was an autobiography which Andrew O'Hagan was involved in, but in some ways Andrew O'Hagan's memoir of the experience is all the more salutary.
Mm-hmm. And he's got an interesting backstory. I mean, he sounds like he's come from the educated elite, but in fact he was born in Glasgow in an Irish Catholic family. His mother was a cleaner, his father was a joiner, and also, unfortunately, a violent alcoholic, we read. So he's really made a way in life that may not have been an easy one to start out with.
Yes, he's got both the outsider and the insider's voice, hasn't he? And that's what makes him such a great writer.
Mm. And actually, just recently, earlier this month, he accepted an invitation from the University of Glasgow for a 5-year honorary professorship at the university in Scottish literature, which is fabulous.
Yeah, so we're dealing with the real deal here, aren't we, Cassie?
Mm. Yes, we are indeed. Now, I feel that we are destined to read this together, Tom, because, what is it, 59 characters that are listed?
Listeners, at the front of this book, and it's got, in a classic fashion, it has a dramatis personae. There are so many characters in it that Andrew O'Hagan has actually listed them all there for you, or Andrew's editor, so that we can follow. So if you're not quite following which of this multitude of contemporary British identity figures, you can just go back to the front and check them out.
Yeah, well, I tell you, it was well thumbed in my copy of this. I was going back to that all the time. But there is one character who is called Cassie Tom. And she, of course, is a supermodel. Cha-ching!
She's when I saw Cassie Tom on the list of characters, I was looking forward to it and hoping there might be a slight riff on the bookshelf, but no. I'm afraid it's a cameo, a brief cameo. And let's just say that Cassie Tom Well, if you know your British supermodels of the last 20 years, you'll recognise who's being portrayed.
You've got a theory about her, haven't you? Okay, well, that's part of the fun of this book, guessing who the characters may or may not be partly based on. And that is just one of the fun aspects. My God, there's so much to talk about, Tom.
This is a magisterial, massive event book. I'm not one who just goes around just sort of making these promises. Dear reader, this is a trip. This is a writer at the peak of his game who's actually had the temerity to write a modern-day Vanity Fair, as we've discussed, or Our Mutual Friend has been discussed elsewhere as one of his inspirations.
Dickens.
But it's also Martin Amis's London Fields. It's also A Dance to the Music of Time, the Anthony Pohl book. It's a slice of life of contemporary Britain, and not a Britain that's in a happy place. This is Boris Johnson, Theresa May Britain. This is,
although unnamed.
They're not named. You're quite right, Cassie. Mm-hmm. But so many other people are, aren't they? But let's just get a sense of the scope of this book. There are five families with multiple characters, working class people, upper class people, people from the arts and people from the communication and media industries, and they all intersect in this one road, this one artery that leads out of London, Caledonian Road. Not named necessarily because it heads in the direction of Scotland. As we learn in the book, it's called Caledonian Road because once there was an orphanage there that was for the dispossessed, lonely and lost Scottish children of the capital. And Andrew O'Hagan, as we've discussed, is a Scot himself. And Caledonian Road becomes literally a road, an artery, a site of exchange and thought and passion inside one of the world's most dynamic cities. But it's also the road back to Scotland and a road from Scotland to London. Scotland and London, they're the two big polar sites.
And through my reading of the book and around the book, I came to understand that Caledonian Road has many parts, and some of it is immensely wealthy and fabulous and beyond, you know, the wealth of ordinary human beings. This is oligarch territory.
Yes.
And in fact, there is a Russian oligarch in this novel. And at the other end, we have workers of all nations, Indian, Polish, Vietnamese, slaving away in a sweatshop that would be at home in a Charles Dickens novel as a workhouse.
Well, and this is one of the big themes of O'Hagan's vision. This is a comprehensive London. On one side, as you walk up Caledonian Road, there is the exquisite Thornhill Square inhabited by the wealthy and those who've made their money out of the contemporary Blairite Britain that is excoriated so successfully.
Asset strippers.
But then on the other side of Caledonian Road are the council estates, where communities that have been left behind by modernity live out their lives. But both these communities are driven by similar passions and intersect, and they intersect in one core way. We have a character that we follow called Campbell Flynn, a writer, an art historian, a broadcaster. He's that sort of very recognisable British type of the public intellectual who, well, Mr. O'Hagan, isn't it interesting? Here we have a Scotsman of Scots-Irish ancestry from a working-class background making a go of it in London. It's not necessarily a self-portrait. It's just an indicator that he knows what he's talking about. And Campbell Flynn has reached that point in his career where all of the baubles and trappings of contemporary London aren't quite giving him what he thought they might.
Although his career is taking off like
going
crazy.
Off, but he's got an emptiness with him.
He's got a bit of ennui.
The Wasteland is referred to a number of times in the course of this remarkably long novel, and there's a bit of a wasteland inside Campbell Flynn, and it's filled by a relationship, a non-sexual relationship, a genuine meeting of minds with one of his young students from University College London, a young man called Milo Mangasha. Milo's half Irish, half Ethiopian, and Milo has all of the catchphrases of the younger generation. He talks about class, he talks about identity, he talks about privilege. Milo comes from the council estates, but he has the education, intelligence and access to the Campbell Flynns of the world.
That's right. He's exceptional because of his intelligence, which has come to him from his parents who have raised him in a hostile environment, but with the intention that everyone can be part of Britain. This is the idea that they raised in him as they raised him, and their hopes and dreams have sort of carried on with him.
Yes, he has working class ambition, mm-hmm. and Campbell Flynn recognises that in a very different way in Milo. But well, this is the key point, isn't it, is that for both of them, Caledonian Road, the street, that road that runs up from King's Cross, this sort of modern metropolis of global economics, all the way up in past Pendleville Prison, is their home. Mm. Both of them are at home striding those streets and walking into those bars, and every single fibre of London is investigated, sniffed, touched, felt by O'Hagan's book. This is one of the greatest books about London that will ever be written. It's real, it's granular, it's authentic in every sense of the word.
Well, interestingly, it's set so precisely in a moment of time, and I think that's part of its genius. It's 2 or 3 days out of lockdown in 2021. And that's really daring, I think, to pinpoint a moment like that, especially when I think I read that he's been working on this for at least a decade. Mm. And what that does, because of its precision, it actually, you know, counterintuitively makes it more translatable to other experience. Because it's so precise, you can actually see your own life.
But isn't that like a basic rule of writing, isn't it? The more specific you are, the more proper your nouns, the more universal you become. And this is the best example of it. Every single element, every character, every moment, every story, every place, O'Hagan knows where we are, and as a result, we do too. And even if you're reading it from the other side of the world and you've never been to London in your life, you realise you're reading a really remarkable book that is about 2024, set in 2021, 2022, sort of that era, but it's about us now. It really speaks to us. I haven't enjoyed and been as stimulated by a book as much as I have by Caledonian Road in years and years. Now, admittedly, I love London, but as I said, you don't need to know London. You don't need to know what these particular clubs are, what the difference between 5 Hertford Street is to the Carlton Club or any of these subtle nuances. You can just go on the ride.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, perhaps it is easier for those who are familiar with those references to digest, but if you don't know them, gee, you have fun tracking all the references down, don't you? Because that's sort of the meta part of this.
I have to admit, Cassie, I read this book with my Google Maps open. So I Google Street View, so I could see what part of Old Bond Street we're in, what part of, you know, Smithfield, whatever. I really felt included.
But not just that. I mean, I have a soft spot for the Dutch Golden Age, and so I'm into it anyway. But he's a specialist on Vermeer in this book. He's just written a book called The Life of Vermeer. And also Rembrandt is in there. So
he's used Vermeer and Rembrandt as examples of artists whose lives, private lives, we could never know. Vermeer captured in almost Polaroid form snapshots of private life, glimpse through windows, glimpse through doors, but we can know almost nothing apart from what we intuit of the characters that Vermeer paints. And to a certain extent, that's what's happening with Campbell Flynn, is that he walks past these doorways and these windows past these sumptuous parties. But likewise, Milo's family and his friends and so on in the working class parts of London are also walking past doors and windows. They're intersected with stories of the human trafficking that so blights the world. And we realise that the people profiteering from the traffic in human beings being transported on the back of shipping containers into Essex from Europe and places beyond, the people that are profiteering from this are the same people who are buying the art and supporting the entire corrupt art world that has kept Campbell Flynn alive. And he begins to, via Milo, through chinks in the wall of these ancient edifices and institutions of contemporary Britain, begin to just get a glimpse that the entire thing is deeply corrupt.
Well, look, obviously we both love this book and we could rabbit on forever, but let's talk about the structure. How would you describe the structure?
The basic story of this is it's about one man's coming into realisation about the falseness of the world. So it has a morality fable. And so there's a protagonist, the aforementioned Campbell Flynn. But along the way, there are so many other characters, all of whom in one way or other intersect with Campbell Flynn and his family's life. There's Russian plutocrats who've made their money out of the Brexit era flow of capital through London. There's figures from his past who he grew up with or went through university with, some of whom are on an upward trajectory and some of whom on a downward trajectory. But then there's also people that he meets through Milo who come from criminal backgrounds and come from music making, from Afro-Caribbean
sort of London identity.
And there's an entire section of this novel which deals with the Polish community in London, which is has always been present and is particularly present since the European years, and some remarkable characters along the way. We're not exaggerating when we say the characters are in their tens and every one of them is finished. Every one of them is a portrait of a different form of contemporary life. Some are amoral, some are moral, some are immoral.
Some are great.
And some are just, well, the vast majority of them are deeply entertaining.
Yes.
Listeners, you will never read a book which has more bon mots, witticisms and aphorisms. There's almost something worth underlining on every page.
Yeah, that's so true.
There are so many quotable quotes. And Oscar Wilde is referred to, but it's not just the wit of Oscar Wilde. It's the wit of Ronald Furbank, of Noel Coward, and of Evelyn Waugh. They're all of these other London voices are present. O'Hagan has an almost metaphysical ability to channel the writers of London and of Britain.
Mm.
I just think this book has such ambition, and it's rare that when you read a book that has continental levels of ambition and then pulls it off. It's almost perfect.
Do you think it's a book that you could read? I mean, it is immense and there are lots of people, and in a way you just have to let it wash over you and trust that you're not going to have to hang on to all the details. But he can't resist a detail, can he?
No, you know? No, and the beauty is in the details, Cassie. Like,
yeah.
This is one of those books where you don't get frustrated by the obsession over what brand of perfume it is.
Like, what about the Russian oligarch's son's
Yuri?
Husband,
yes,
who has his eyelids dusted with gold glitter in one of the clubs at lunch?
Yes.
I mean, that sticks out in my mind.
And this is a portrait of decadence, isn't it? This is one of O'Hagan's point. There is a morality to this book, which is to, this is why I referred to Vanity Fair before. It's that Bunyan-esque, that Thackeray-esque sense of look at what we've become. We no longer make anything. We no longer do anything. We just trade. And what we're trading in is ephemeral.
This is one of the ideas that's wrestled with, you know, the idea that Britain's turned into a nation of shopkeepers. And then someone later on questions, well, is that a problem, you know?
Well, it's and indeed, because this is a country which has lost its compass. Towards the end of the book, there's a fabulous section where Britain, contemporary Britain, Britain in the 21st century is described. Britain, where the routines of civility, the ways of society, and the habits of art are threaded with a history of brutality. And that's what this book's about, because there's such brutality in this world. The poor migrants trying desperately to find legal or illegally their way into London. Just what it's like to try and make a living as a working class man or woman up and down the Caledonian Road. But also the aristocracy, they're brutal to each other. They're brutal to their own family. Language is a form of barbed wire that they lash each other with.
No one seems to really know each other except for the very special and lucky few.
But we find this delightful. There's a kind of delight in the way language is used as a weapon through this. The amount of times that there's the clever put down, the acerbic commentary.
Look, I can see your copy and you've colour-coded your 50,000 post-it notes and stickers. I had pens out with different colours. But I just gave up in the end.
Oh, this book rewards reading. This is the reason we read, people. Just books like Caledonian Road, because the thoughts and the associations that it brings up in you, it'll be different for everyone. But there's a section where they go to the opera Eugene Onegin at Garsington at the Opera Festival. And so it's the aristocracy in full flight. And you come to realise such is a master like O'Hagan, is that the Pushkin original, the Eugene Onegin, is to a certain extent what Campbell Flynn is going through. He's both observer but also victim of a society that's profoundly telling lies to itself. And yet you never feel preached to. You never feel like O'Hagan's wagging his finger at you, although he is. But he's so good at writing, and this one just flowed along. I just could quite happily just sit there reading it for a weekend. In fact, I did.
Yeah, it is an investment for sure, but one that is so rewarding and delightful, and you'll just come away from it wanting to remember everything because all those lines. They're so wonderful. It's about race, but really it's about class and opportunity. And I just opened a random page here because I was looking for what I'd scribbled in the margins, but here's this line here. This is an older man talking to a younger man. "You're a handsome young man. Don't stay here. That's my advice. Go home to your own people. England is no place for strangers anymore." Just a random page. It's so good.
But it's, as we say, Cassie, this book is full of them along the way. There's a wonderful section where he says, where Campbell's can look at a picture, but the big picture escapes him. And that's the kind of the horror.
Actually, that's
of the
interesting
story.
Because at one point reading this, I thought this is pointillist. There are so many dots of colour in this. It's not until you move back that you see you've been standing in front of a landscape. That's the structure, I think.
Yeah.
Just details, just filling this picture of Britain right now.
Yep. It won't be to everyone's taste, but everybody, I think, will admire the achievement.
If you're strong enough to hold it up. It's called Caledonian Road, and it's by Andrew O'Hagan. Well, let's meet today's guest reviewers. Sue Turnbull is Senior Professor in Communication and Media at the University of Wollongong. She's also an author and Chief Crime Fiction Reviewer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Great to have you back, Sue.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Sam Twyford-Moore is author of the socio-political history Castmates, Australian Actors in Hollywood and at Home, and a researcher in the history of Australian cinema. Hi, Sam. Great to have you back too.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back.
Tom and I have just been talking about Andrew O'Hagan's book, Caledonian Road, which is epic. How many pages, Tom? 641, did we say?
Oh, and so much more.
There's 59 characters listed, in the beginning, just a handy guide. What's one of the longest books you've ever read, Sue?
Well, there's a question of duration. I mean, there are some books that seem incredibly long, but actually aren't. And then there are books that are incredibly long, but then you read quite quickly. And I think J.K. Rowling falls somewhere in between those two, in the sense that her last two crime novels have been so big that I actually decided to read them on a Kindle because my wrists were getting sore.
Ah, this is the Robert Galbraith series.
Yes, the Robert Galbraith series.
And do you rate them?
I do like them. And they have created a particular world in their own way that is inhabited by these characters, and you get to know them. I mean, it's almost like a kind of soap opera in the sense that, you know, what's the next development? And I know people are getting incredibly frustrated between about the relationship between the two central characters, Cormorant Strike and, what do they call his wonderful partner, Robin? And that on again, off again, the way in which they are walking round each other in an earthy relationship is driving a lot of people bonkers.
But is crime fiction. Every detective has to have a problem with alcohol, probably a limp, and I think Cormorant Strike does actually have a limp, doesn't he?
Well, he's actually missing half a leg.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because of his war injuries.
That's right.
So, yes.
And then a problematic relationship.
You've got to keep the interest happening on multiple levels, don't you? It's not just like you want the linear crime. You've got to have the complications to kind of engage the reader.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but maybe getting a bit baggy. What about you, Sam?
Oh, I have a terrible confession to make. I did the obligatory early 20s reading of David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, which I think is about 1,000 pages, maybe more if you include those end notes at the back. I got to page 950 and I stopped reading it.
Oh, well done.
Wow.
And I just forgot about it. And I haven't gone back since, so I can't say that I've read Infinite Jest, but I've read 95% of it. Maybe one day I'll get back there, but I'll be pretty lost, I'd say.
Well, that's far more admirable than the 5% of Gravity's Rainbow that I've read. What about you, Tom?
I got further than you in Gravity's Rainbow, but I got nowhere near as far as you in Infinite Jest. And I, like so many people, have War and Peace sitting on my Sundoku, and I know I'm never going to read it.
Oh, no. No, it's a goal. It's a life goal.
One day when I have the hours.
Well, we have some time now, so let's turn to the books you've read for us. Sue, you've read Halfway House by Helen Fitzgerald. We'll get to that. But first, let's go to The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton. Now, Tom, it sounds like Stuart Turton's first novel got the reception that every wannabe writer dreams of.
Oh, I'm sure listeners will remember The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. It was described by its publishers as Gosford Park meets Inception by way of Agatha Christie. And it won the Best First Novel Prize in the 2018 Costa Book Awards, as I'm sure you remember, Cassie. It was shortlisted for Debut of the Year at the British Book Awards, so Stuart Turton has something of a pedigree already. It had a mind-bending, time-looping plot that was clearly trying to develop something new in terms of genre, and it's reportedly sold billions of copies in different formats. A Netflix adaptation's been announced early this year, and then it's all collapsed, as so many of them do. And then in 2020, Turton's book The Devil in the Dark Water followed. Set in the 1600s, sea saga, complete with murder and conspiracy and gothic elements. And it was extremely well received critically. And now we have The Last Murder at the End of the World.
So, Sam, where are we? And I guess more importantly, when?
Oh, I don't actually know the year, but we're on an island which is surrounded by a poisonous fog filled with insects. Within that island, there is a group of villagers and a mysterious trio of scientist elders who might be doing some experiments on the villagers. And that's where we start, and then we go from there, and it's a pretty quick start, and then we move into maybe a different genre pretty quickly as well.
So these three scientists have survived this cataclysm 90 years earlier, so it's almost as if time slowed down for them, isn't it? These are human beings, but capable of living for a very long time. And they're scientists, as you say, but they've also got their secrets. Tell us a bit about our Nima, our maternal matriarch.
Very much the matriarch of the island, a beloved figure, but maybe has some dark secrets to her. She is in charge of this village, and then she has two sort of apprentices as well as a bunch of assistants, and they're all working on some kind of experiment that's slowly teased throughout the novel. Mm. But she's not really our main character. She becomes something else, and it is a tricky novel to talk about because there are not one, not two, probably three or four twists throughout the book, and characters kind of fall in and out.
Oh, Sam, four, you're being generous. There are 400 twists and turns. This is labyrinthine, isn't it? But Stuart Turton's a sophisticated writer. This isn't something which you just sort of read and forget about. There's things going on here. This is a bit of a riff on the island of Dr. Moreau, and there's a sense of the Tempest as well at work, except instead of one Miranda, we have an entire village, as you say, these villagers. And there's something intriguing, is that the villagers come from elsewhere, that we realise that the humans aren't haven't actually got fellow humans, because these villagers don't give birth. They're parents, they exist in families, they're male and female, but the children are provided for them by the three humans.
Yeah, and
that's not such a spoiler, is it?
No, I think you're going to find some pretty classic sci-fi tropes in here. There's computers, AI, magic, wizardry. Of course, there's clones. You know, there's always going to be clones. It's interesting that you mentioned that the Evelyn Hardcastle book fell over as a project at Netflix, because as I was reading this, I'm like, is this a writer who is writing for a TV deal almost? And maybe he was making up for that failed deal, because it does have that kind of mini-series sort of feel to it. It's a little overstuffed, you know, and episodic, I suppose.
Well, in the spirit of a TV show, TV viewers like to know what they're getting. This one starts off, as you say, as a kind of dystopic science fiction genre feel, but then it becomes a murder mystery, and the vast majority of the pages in this novel, from a reader's point of view, are in the form of following and watching your beloved detective figure, in this case one of the villagers, as she tries to work out exactly who has committed a fiendish murder. It's been an idyll. It's been an almost idealised place up until then, and now suddenly death has visited this paradise. How successful is it as a book of solving the mystery as opposed to a world-building one, Sam?
Yeah, that's a good point. It does take 100, you know, there's sort of 150 pages of world-building and then it suddenly becomes a murder mystery and you're sort of turned to the left and you go, how did I get here? As a murder mystery, I'm not so sure, because I think the thing we haven't talked about, and this isn't a spoiler, is the book is narrated by an AI character.
Mm-hmm.
So Abby is AI, standing for artificial biological intelligence. I'm not sure what the difference is there. And because she's AI, surely she knows who the murderer is, and yet she's not revealing that. And there's a challenge where the characters have to discover who the murderer
is. This is what's most interesting about it, isn't it? Because it's the old Agatha Christie, Roger Ackroyd thing. You realise, oh, one of the joys of it is when you follow the rules and when you don't. And Abby doesn't follow rules, including the compact between narration and reader. And so even if you do get a little bit frustrated with the endless kind of breathtaking cliffhangers and so on of the book, you can think and ponder the idea of what it means to have an artificial intelligence that can reach into the minds of everyone on the island and provide them with all the information the AI presumes they need. But it's completely at Abby's discretion, and you get frustrated with your own narrator as opposed to with the characters. So I actually found this quite an extraordinary reading experience, but not for anything to do with the plot.
Explain it's
been written.
So, Sam, how does this work? I mean, what you're saying, that Abby, the artificial biological intelligence, can actually go into people's brains.
It seems she goes in through their DNA, up through the veins, into their brains and controls them and sort of talks to them. So there's a lot of dialogue from Abby. I think there's a really interesting, if you step back, a kind of narratological question here, because Abby is the narrator and she has dialogue, but her dialogue is very different, and the way she speaks to these characters is very different to how the book is narrated. And I think there was maybe a little bit of a missed opportunity here that Stewart could have created more of an interesting first-person narrator voice, but it's kind of written and reads in the kind of classical third-person narrator. And you could also do some really interesting, tricky stuff with moving from omnipresent third-person to that sort of limited third person, which he does do, but it doesn't feel like he is as excited as potentially the reader is with the potential for that.
It's the age-old quandary, though, isn't it? Like, when you're dealing with a strong narrative voice as the reader, you can often get frustrated and say, well, don't stop teasing me, just tell me. If you know, just tell me. And in many ways, that's true of all authors, isn't it? So Stuart Turton sort of invented in the form of Abby this intelligence, a play on the idea of what it is to be a reader and what it is to be a writer. And I found that fascinating. I love that. And it has implicit within it the kind of the classic problem of an unreliable narrator. Is Abby telling us the truth and sharing with us? Well, we know she isn't sharing with us everything because she isn't doing it to her own islanders and her own characters in her own story.
Is this not Hal in 2001 A Space Odyssey?
But not in the strictest sense, but if you can imagine a Hal who can enter into the minds and thoughts of the people on the spacecraft, then we're getting closer. But this is a fascinating set of propositions. There's this fog we've talked about, which is surrounding the island, and if anything organic goes into the fog, it's swarms of insects rapaciously devour. So you're completely constrained by this fog and the image of the fog that's surrounding the island. And presumably the rest of the world has been destroyed. But there's a lighthouse still sending out its beams and still powered to send out beams into this all-consuming fog. Who's the light for? Who's it sending a signal to, and what's its significance? And Abby doesn't comment on this. It's just left there that there are certain inconsistencies, and you begin to realise, in Turton's sort of fairly masterful vision, there's subterranean levels to this island, as there always are.
Oh, it's not a sort of biblical light.
No.
Okay. Now, Sue Turnbull, you are a crime reviewer. You've had a look at this. What did you make of the setup?
I loved the map at the start, and I spent quite a long time looking at that map because, you know, as someone who has over the years loved fantasy of one sort or another, a good map and that establishment of that world, you know, from The Hobbit onwards, Narnia, love a map. And so I started to read it, and I pretty soon figured out that Abby was something extraordinary. And then I have to say that I resisted the pull to enter the fictional world. I just went, I'm not in the mood for this. And I have to admit that I had just finished reading the Helen Fitzgerald. And it's a big shift in tone to go from the Fitzgerald to the Turton. And I thought, really, I don't think I have the patience to go through a fictional universe in this way with these characters, and I have to admit that I flicked to the end, and yes, I had guessed. I knew who the murderer was. So as a murder mystery, it kind of didn't intrigue me and compel me to get into it.
That must be an occupational hazard for you, though, Sue.
I think it is. Definitely.
Well, what does it succeed in doing, Sam?
I think the basic concept is there. You know, it touches on these things that we're interested in at the moment. It is 2024, feels like the year of discussing AI. I'm sure there might be other books out there that discuss it in a more in-depth way, but this is an interesting way to yoke it into a fantasy, crime, speculative fiction, sci-fi, multi-genre sort of epic. So I'm glad that was in there, and all power to him.
And he takes a nice big deep breath, Turton, as a writer. He's not afraid to write a big story with epic themes and landscapes. And so I sort of admired the ambition if I got a little frustrated along the way by the intricacies.
I'd say, like, he's spinning a lot of plates in this book, and the risk with spinning plates is you end up spinning your wheels, and it doesn't really, you know, the wheels don't spin. You don't stop and go, oh, I've had enough of this. He keeps the plates up in the air, even if there's maybe one too many.
I've just got a quandary, Sam, about this book, which is if you're going to create a species of humans that's not necessarily generated by procreation, why have genders and sexes? What's the purpose of the villagers and their constant mirror replication of this human world that they're meant to have left behind and ended in environmental cataclysm? Why not create a genderless utopia? What are these villages? And is there some elaborate analogy for post-colonial consciousness at work here, or is there something else going on?
I guess the question is, why recreate humans at all if we've destroyed ourselves? Why replace us?
Well, the answer in this book is that they're, and this is something that is useful to know about Turton's book, is that the villagers by day live their lives, but then they fall asleep at sort of at dusk every night, and then in a somnolent sort of a somnambulistic state do labour for the humans all night. So they work all day and they work all night. Some of it they're conscious of and some of it they're not. It's not a, well, as I say, it was a dystopic, not a utopian view of future lives.
Quite grim is also Turton's idea that equality should be that everyone has the same age limit. So all of these villagers all die at age 60, which feels a bit mean, I think.
They know it's coming.
That's true. Scary.
Oh, well, okay. So his interesting and varied writing career continues. This one is called The Last Murder at the End of the World.
Cassie, you and Sue have been reading something else which is not quite what it claims to be, or not quite what we think it's going to be, another book, Halfway House by Helen Fitzgerald.
Yeah, it's not kind of exactly crime, although a lot of crime occurs within it, Sue.
There are criminals in here, yes, and they are living in a halfway house, which hence the title.
Well, let's explain the setup. It's about this young woman who's called Lou. She's Australian, and she moves to Edinburgh, and she applies for all these lowly admin and retail jobs, everything that's available in Edinburgh before she leaves. And she has rejections and ghostings and everything. But then she does this online interview and lands a job that is, well, very unusual.
It is an unusual job. It is located in a halfway house for serious criminals who are essentially moving from a prison term back into the population. And the name of this particular organisation is, in fact, well, it is the Supported Accommodation Services for Offenders, Lothian, which, as she discovers in a telephone interview, is called Sarsol. Now, that gives you an indication that this is a book that is to be read for the humour, the dark humour, which erupts almost on every page. This is one of the funniest books I have read for a long time. Not a book to read on the train because you end up snickering, as I did this morning as I reread the first 50 pages. And people look at you, especially when you're on the quiet carriage. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, which went to places that I had no expectation that it would go. There's even what I call a Salt Burnie moment when she meets the wonderful Tim. She's just got off the plane. Her cousin Bex is in a play at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is going on at the time. And she goes to see the play, which is actually a musical called Plath! Exclamation mark, the musical, which is clearly based on the life of Sylvia Plath and a less promising subject for a musical you'd probably be pushed to come up with. She goes to the musical, she immediately falls asleep, but there's this lovely young man sitting next to her who smells of sandalwood, and he ends up becoming her lover in Edinburgh. And there's a lot more to be said about the sex in this particular book, but just to finish that Saltburn line, it turns out that Tim is actually the son of very wealthy parents, now deceased, and they have a hunting lodge out in the country which she goes to visit. So she's terribly impressed by Tim. Mm,
yes, is it Tavisdale?
Oh, something? Tavisdale Lodge.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
Lots of dead animals on the wall.
And he's good looking and he's wearing cashmere and he smells fantastic.
He's got a Gucci watch and yeah. Saint Laurent shoes and he smells beautiful.
Yeah, it's his sandalwood that she
Yes, and he agrees to have sex in the alley with her, which for Lou is the way she prefers to have sex. And what's wonderful about
She's
this book is you
type.
Get all that backstory.
Well, we should talk about that. I mean, let's talk about what happens before she arrives in Edinburgh, because Tom and Sam, we're not just making this up. Actually, she really has problems having sex indoors for complex reasons. So
for complex reasons indeed, because her bedroom has become a safe space. We get the backstory that her father was a sergeant major in the army and the family have moved all the time. They've been moving and she's had to pack up. She loves packing. And she's had to compartmentalize and she packs friends. She's had to make new friends wherever she goes. And her very first boyfriend and she, as teenagers, had wild sex everywhere. But she's just emerged from a relationship, a two-year relationship with a married man called Alan, who has set her up in an expensive flat with an allowance of money. And from the ages of 21 to 23...
$8,000 a month.
$8,000 a month.
Plus the
Armani leather jackets and the Versace leather jacket. And he's treated her extremely well. And she only has to see him twice a week for 3 hours at a time, and the sex is very, very short and very, very brief, and she has to lie absolutely still. But it's worth it for all the other perks that she gets. Having gone through that, however, when she gets to Edinburgh, the joy of having sex outside with Tim in alleyways and wherever on the train is her idea of absolute heaven, because she doesn't want anybody in her bedroom.
Mm-hmm. So she's complicated. She's 23. She's sort of excited about the world, but she doesn't come without baggage. And so when she begins work at Sarsol, this accommodation service for very high-risk offenders, which she hadn't noticed the very high until reading the fine print. It's a 5-bedroom facility.
Yes.
And these people are the worst of the worst, but unfortunately their terms have come to an end. Their prison terms have come to an end. I mean, they are revolting. We shouldn't be laughing because they are awful. And I will just say there are some challenging ideas in this. And the book does have themes of suicide and criminal sexual behaviour as well. So
Yes. Just
having said that, inside the facility is a pedophile who is likened to Jimmy Savile. There is a person who goes into chat rooms and tries to convince people to kill themselves, revolting character. Who else is in there?
There's Rob, who is the sexual pest of one sort or another. And then there is Doug, the paranoid drug dealer.
That's right. He always thinks that people he owes money to are about to turn up and beat him to death. He thinks this approximately 6 o'clock every night. He thinks
that's
he's
what's
got to
going
get
to happen.
£5,000 or £6,000 together very quickly. That's
yes. But given that Helen Fitzgerald has worked in the criminal justice system, as awful as these men's crimes actually are, she also humanizes them. And in some cases, we get their background as to why they are the way they are. So we have Lou working in this facility, and she really only works there 3 nights before everything kind of falls apart. But what is wonderful about this book is that as someone who's written comedy and written screenwriters, Fitzgerald does not miss a beat. There are things that are set up right from the start where you get her hitting the beat later on in the book. So, for example, at the very, very end of the book, one of her co-workers says to her, after all these incidents have unfolded, yeah, they'll probably want you on 60 Minutes. You shouldn't do that because you're not going to come over very well. Now, in fact, that is exactly where the book begins. She's on 60 Minutes, not coming over very well, and getting all these hashtags, including Luscious Lou and hashtag Lou the Impaler, which gives you some idea of where this book might go.
Yeah, and she has in her mind her father's advice, only answer direct questions. You know, the army father has given her advice. But see, people who are listening closely will notice that we've only outlined four of the inmates. Want to have a guess at who the fifth is, Tom, Sam?
No, don't do that, because it's such a wonderful moment when that reveal actually occurs. It's quite glorious. I was thrilled by that moment. Loved it.
Yeah. And we never quite know how it's going to work out right to the end.
She's very much a father's daughter, though. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which those beats are set up. She's resourceful. She's been hunting and fishing. She knows how to survive. She's beaten off a shark on a shark attack. Lou may look like a gorgeous, innocent 23-year-old.
Oh, yeah, we didn't mention that. She's actually stunning,
She is obviously a very, very attractive young woman. Everybody is taken in by that. But she is resourceful with all her quirks and all her foibles. She is actually a very strong and feisty character, and I loved her.
Yeah. Look, I was surprised by this book because I wasn't expecting it to be really a character study of her. And she's messed up and she's trying to make her way in the world as a young woman in her 20s, figuring out, leaving home, going, having complex relationships, going for what she wants. And she's kind of no nonsense.
But it's also the innocent abroad, isn't it? She's Australian for a good reason. It's that idea of going to a complicated, dark, morally questionable other world and bringing something fresh and new. There's a kind of self-portraiture at work, isn't there?
Well, I totally identified with her, I have to say. I mean, there might be 50 years between us, but I remember going to Edinburgh, and I actually worked at the Edinburgh Festival. I have been in that environment. I was running the press office at the Assembly Rooms in 1983 when Los Trios Ringbarkers won the Perrier Award. I've been in that environment, all that madness and all those kind of weird moments that occur, including, you know, shows not quite like Plath the Musical, but very similar.
Got any backstage stories to tell us, Sue?
Well, at the Assembly Rooms, we had French and Saunders. We also had Rick Mayall and Ben Elton and crew. And I got invited to their parties. And I ended up at one particular party snogging Rick Mayall. So I know all about what happens when you are 23 in Edinburgh during the festival.
Oh, gold star. Fantastic.
Come to the bookshelf for all the real news.
I loved Rick Mayall so much. Yeah, no, look, this is a really surprising book, and I like it. I like it as well. So, and I like Helen Fitzgerald. I think she's a unique voice because it doesn't do the genre bending, I guess, that the Stuart Turton has done. But it's not what it seems when you first set out in this book.
Oh, it's a cracker of a read as well. I really enjoyed it, and it was nice to discover.
Oh, Sam, you've looked at it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The absolute cracker read, but it was nice to discover an Australian writer who I didn't know, and I think that happens sometimes when Australians move overseas. You don't often hear of these little success stories, so it was really fun to find someone new.
Yeah, because she's now living in Glasgow.
Well, her breakthrough book was The Cry, which of course got adapted for television. And having read this, I then went back and read The Cry. And I have to say, I like the book much better than the television adaptation.
Oh, I quite liked the adaptation. Okay, well, Helen Fitzgerald, she's got 13 books to her name, including The Cry and now Halfway House, which I think it's getting a bit of a tick.
I think it'll make a fantastic television series.
You'd have to get around a few of those sensibilities about the criminals. And, I think it would be.
Well, if you can make a Mick Herron spy thriller where people are getting beheaded into a TV series, I'm sure you can do this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. It's on offer for someone who might be listening. Just before we part company, a couple of book recommendations. Sam Twyford Moore, what are you reading?
Well, thinking about islands and bodies of water, I've been reading the late poet Robert Adamson's Birds and Fish, Life on the Hawkesbury. It's a really beautiful little book published posthumously by Upswell Press. It covers some of the same territory, Robert's beautiful memoir from 2004, so we're looking 20 years back, inside out, but it's a lovely little read and a nice little send-off to Robert.
So what form's it in?
It's sort of like a memoir in the form of a diary with prose poems and some poetry, but the core of the book is Robert nursing his bird that he found on the ground to health, Spinoza, who was such a big part of the end of Robert's life. And so it's a lovely tribute.
What kind of bird?
It's a bowerbird, I think. It's like a little thing and, you know, just tough. But Robert famously stole a bird from Taronga Zoo, a rifle bird in his boyhood, which is covered in both this book and his classic memoir. So he was a naughty boy and he grew up to just love birds and fish.
Oh, and love them being free. Okay. It's called
Birds and Fish.
Birds and Fish. There you go. What about you, Sue?
Well, staying with the crime genre, I've just finished reading Candace Fox's latest, Devil's Kitchen, which I have to say I really enjoyed. As an Australian writer, I think this is a return to her first three books that came out as a trio, which began with Hades, because it's very, very, very dark, but it is actually set in New York, and it's about firemen. It's about firemen who have survived the World Trade disaster and are now embarked on a different kind of career.
Actually, Candace Fox was just here recently and she told us about doing the research for that, where she pretty much just barreled up to fire stations and asked them all kinds of questions and for a look around.
Well, there's a lot of detail about the kind of going through fires and these men actually literally walking into fires in their suits. I mean, I had no idea that you could do that, but clearly that's what one does now to fight a fire.
Well, they're heroes. Everyday heroes, for sure. Well, both of you, thank you for those recommendations, but also for reading for us today. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sue Turnbull is Professor in Communication and Media at the University of Wollongong and Chief Crime Fiction Reviewer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And Sam Twyford Moore's book is Castmates, Australian Actors in Hollywood and at Home. Now, Tom, thank you. Great reading with you once again. The next time we catch up, you and I will be looking at the final and unfinished work by the brilliant Australian writer Charmian Clift, who died in 1969.
Yes, Charmian Clift's beloved of so many readers and remembered so well for a remarkably lived life and a very richly lived one, but not just as a writer, but also as a human being and a great figure of Australian life in the post-war years, her time that she spent with her husband, George Johnston, in Greece with her family.
And then fellow writer, George.
Well, yes, author of Clean Straw for Nothing, My Brother Jack and so on. But Charmian Clift, when she came back to Australia through her columns that she wrote for the then Fairfax papers, developed a following as one of those very early examples of the columnist whom you felt you knew and whose opinions you felt you shared. But her unpublished memoir of her childhood in Kiama and her youth and so on, because that's in a fictionalised form fundamentally what this new book is, we'll be talking about a little bit later on the bookshelf.
Yes, it's a project that's been brought to life by some of her greatest fans, including the writer Nadia Wheatley. And so that's called The End of the Morning, and that's in a couple of weeks' time. Maybe you want to track it down. I think you might be able to get a copy already. So, yeah, that's one we'll be reading. Looking forward to it, Tom.
Thanks for having me on the shelf, Cassie, and I'll see you next time.
Always great to have you. On our next episode, Michaela Kolovsky will be here, and we're looking at Bree Lee's book, The Work, which is about money, ambition, art and love. Also, Michaela Saunders always will be, a speculative fiction set in the Tweed. And the latest from Andre Assaman, the author of Call Me By Your Name, which was made into that incredible movie starring Timothée Chalamet. His new book is called The Gentleman from Peru, and it's about a group of friends who are holidaying on the Amalfi Coast who encounter a beguiling stranger. I'm Cassie McCullough. Until next time, happy reading.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.